A recent court case has a lot of people talking about the responsibilities of businesses to support breastfeeding moms. Today, we'll talk about the changing culture of our workplaces as breastfeeding numbers rise among working moms. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The percentage of moms in the United States who breastfeed has been increasing in recent years, and so has the number of businesses that make accommodations for those moms, even though conflicts still arise. This hour, support for breastfeeding in the workplace, cultural views and barriers to breastfeeding in the United States and in Iowa. We'll also talk about cultural views of breastfeeding among those who come to our state from other parts of the world. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals recently ruled that a woman who worked for Nationwide Insurance in Des Moines could not sue her former employer in a sex and pregnancy discrimination case. But the details of her complaint have started a lot of conversations about support for breastfeeding women in the workplace. When Angela Ames returned to work after her maternity leave, she had trouble accessing the lactation room at the company to pump breast milk. As her frustration over that increased, her department head encouraged her to, quote, go home and be with your babies, and even dictated a letter of resignation to her. She did resign from her job, and the court found that she didn't have grounds for a suit because she was not fired and didn't pursue her complaint through the company's human resources department. That's the story of one case, but there have been many over the years. On the flip side, many businesses have been working hard to be more accommodating to nursing mothers. Jennifer Pitkin is an international board-certified lactation consultant. She's also a leader in La Leche League, and she works with businesses to help them institute breastfeeding policies for employees and for patrons. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Good. Of course.
Now, what are businesses in the state of Iowa required to do by law for nursing mothers?
We have a federal law in place that requires employers to provide break time and space for covered non-exempt nursing mothers to express breast milk for 1 year.
Okay. And by providing space, what specifically does that mean?
It means that it needs to be functional for expressing milk. It needs to be shielded from view. It needs to be free from intrusion, it needs to be available as needed, and it may not be a restroom.
Now, you work with businesses when they are going through the process of creating this space or making changes to support breastfeeding mothers. Often you're called in when there's been a problem, right?
It's true.
But give me an idea of what you can do to help a business through this transition, because I understand that for some businesses, this is something they just haven't encountered before.
What we do is we provide positive marketing for businesses to ensure that patrons seek out places that will welcome nursing and pumping mothers. So I'd like to use an example to compare to Nationwide Insurance recent incidents. And this is the Mutual of Omaha, Nebraska. And they put in 3 4x5 expression places for their employees, and they were named one of the 100 best companies for working women by Working Mother magazine. If companies are to institute policies and lactation programs for their employees, they're more likely to have employees or that are going to be loyal. And more patrons will seek out these businesses simply because of their marketing. More mothers are going to spend their money there. They're a huge spending demographic, and it's simply something that businesses are missing out on.
Well, I was just going to ask you that because there's one, you know, being in compliance with the law is one thing. Mm-hmm. Actually being accommodating and making nursing mothers who come back to work feel comfortable and making sure that they can do what they need to do, that's another thing. But what's in it for the business to go beyond the setting aside of a private space?
There are two very important things. One, for the benefit for the employers, outside of simply looking like a place that just advocates for its employees, is that it lowers healthcare costs. Employees miss less work because their babies are simply sick less often. And if the babies are sick, simply they also are sick with less severity. So they're saving money. When they have this positive image, they're gaining more money. They're promoting themselves as a company that mothers should frequent. And if they're not doing so, they're not reaching the spending demographic that, like I said, is simply missed.
Right. Well, and you also said that these mothers are more likely to stay there. Does it create a lot of employee loyalty?
Absolutely. Mothers who know that they have this comfortable environment where they're not stressed out, they can just go there and get back to their work, not worrying about things that are going on at home that are outside of their control.
You also work with businesses to be more accommodating for patrons as well, right?
We do.
Now, what's in it for a business there? I mean, they're not required to set aside a space for patrons.
Well, technically they are. Federal legislation does, in most places, I should say, allow that a mother nurse wherever she's otherwise allowed to be. So an employee telling a mother that she needs to cover up or move, or that another patron is saying that they're uncomfortable, they should be protecting the mother that is nursing her little one. So state law and federal law often do not have an enforcement provision. So the law is a little bit wonky in that they don't know that they'll get in trouble for it. But the negative publicity is huge. Facebook, Twitter, the explosion of social media quickly makes for change.
Jennifer, thank you so much for telling us about this. Jennifer Pitkin is an international board certified lactation consultant. I want to take a look back in time now as well. We were talking about how things are changing in the workplace today. Well, we're going to go back 30 years. Sharon Lake received a PhD in American Studies from the University of Iowa in 2010. Her thesis for that degree involved in-depth research into a story of a breastfeeding working mom more than 30 years ago. If you were in Iowa at the time, you may remember this story. Lake spoke with us earlier to tell the story of the nursing mother who was a firefighter in Iowa City.
I got interested in studying the case of Linda Eaton when I took a class on gender and the law in my first semester of graduate school. And what we learned in that class was the significance that one case and one person can have on the broader society and culture. Linda Eaton's story started really when she got hired for the Iowa City Fire Department in 1977. She's one of the very first women in the country to be hired onto a professional fire department. Women were just barely starting to get their foot in the doors of fire departments. There were some in volunteer departments, but even those were quite close to them. So it was front page news with the Press Citizen that she had been hired. And, you know, let's just say it made some waves at the department that she was hired. She became pregnant about 8 or 9 months after she was hired, and she was a single woman. So the department put her on light duty, but they were pretty unhappy about that. She was on light duty. She had the baby. She was a member of La Leche League, and she, you know, was committed to nursing her child. And so when it was time for her to come back to work, which was January of 1979, she got in touch with the fire chief and told him what day she could come back, and said that she was nursing her child. And what she would like to do is have a family member bring her baby to the fire station during the lunch hour and the dinner hour, so that she could nurse the baby in her locker room, so that if she could at least nurse it twice a day, that she, you know, would be able to provide pumped milk the rest of the time, because firefighters work 24-hour shifts. So she proposed that to the fire chief, and he said, you know, no, you can't do that. And she persisted in asking him, you know, why not? And she really didn't feel like he had a good answer. He said things like, well, you won't get to the truck in time. But the point is that in the fire station, people are there for 24 hours. They sleep there. They take showers there. They watch TV. They do all kinds of things. They use the bathroom. So as she pointed out, it's not going to take me any longer than it would take anybody else, you know, to get ready for a fire. But he persisted in saying that she couldn't, you know, she couldn't do that. So she did not follow the instructions of the fire chief. When she came back to work the first day, she had her mother bring the baby at lunch hour. The baby came in, she breastfed the baby, and then they dismissed her without pay for the rest of the day. She did it again the next time, and then they told her, if you do this again, we're going to fire you. Well, that's the point at which the third time when she was nursing, a fire alarm did go off, and she was the second person on the truck. which really undermined that argument that the city had. By that time, her case had become national. There were picketers outside the fire station, you know, every day. She went on to the Phil Donahue show. And, you know, she gained a lot of sympathy both in Iowa City and around the country. A lot of people wrote her letters then. This was in the days when people still wrote letters. That was one of the great things that was saved at the State Historical Society, was all these hundreds of letters that she received from around the country. And people would write and say, well, I heard about your case, and first I thought that you were just one of those angry women out to prove a point. Then I saw you on the television, and I realized that you're just a mother trying to do the best you can. By you need a job because you have to support your son, and you have a good job, and you're trying to be a good mother. So, like, what's wrong with that? So she gained a lot of support when people saw her and heard her story. Not every letter that she received was supportive. It was a minority, for sure, of the letters, but some letters got extremely nasty. That kind of reflected the other side of how people saw her. They used language that we wouldn't want to use on the air to describe her and called her all kinds of names. She was also the subject, you know, sometimes some of those things would be written, like she came home one time and found something on her mailbox that was really nasty. I think Linda Eaton's case is important today for several reasons. First of all, it is somewhat shocking to look at it 30 plus years on and realize how controversial breastfeeding still is. You know, we have to have laws to allow women to breastfeed in public places still. When I was writing it, there was a big case out in West Branch, and there was a protest out there because a woman had been asked to leave a restaurant because she was nursing. So the issue has not gone away of the uncomfortableness of Americans with breastfeeding, period. I think, secondly, it's very important today because it goes to this issue of how women can be, as one person said who wrote to Linda Eaton, you're trying to be, you know, a good worker and a good mother at the same time.
Sharon Lake, who a few years ago completed research about Linda Eaton, a mother and an Iowan firefighter who nursed her baby at the firehouse more than 30 years ago. We'll continue our conversation about breastfeeding as the hour goes on. Next, we're going to talk about cultural differences among immigrants who come to the United States, who come to Iowa. Different views about breastfeeding, different beliefs about breastfeeding from different cultures. And then we'll focus more on our own culture. We'll talk about views about breastfeeding in Iowa and the United States, how some of those views have been changing, cultural barriers to breastfeeding as well. And you're welcome to join our conversation as the hour goes on. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about breastfeeding. We, of course, in this country are still experiencing a cultural divide when it comes to breastfeeding. But the picture becomes even more complicated when we take into account other cultures and their breastfeeding practices and beliefs. Michelle Devlin is a professor of health promotion and education at the University of Northern Iowa. She's also director of the Iowa Center on Health Disparities and a specialist in refugee and immigrant maternal and child health. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And of course, when people are in a situation where they have to leave their country quickly, refugees that come to the United States, I can imagine that that puts many people in a position of having a lot of health risks, particularly for infants.
Yes, it definitely does. We're always concerned among refugee populations about illness rates and death rates. And we know when we work with refugee populations in foreign countries, their death and illness rates for most conditions can be dozens, if not hundreds of times higher than those rates that are seen, you know, in surrounding communities.
Well, and we're going to focus specifically on breastfeeding. When people come here from other cultures, we, of course, know a lot about the benefits of breastfeeding for the health of an infant. When you're working with a specific group, what do you need to know about their cultural beliefs about breastfeeding?
We always want to take a look when we work with them and ask them, we do ask them these questions. What were you doing back home? What were the typical ways that you were feeding your children? You know, what were you doing in terms of breastfeeding? What were you doing with colostrum, the very first milk from the mother within the first few hours, first day or so? What kinds of weaning foods are you introducing to a child? When are you introducing that? And how long totally are you breastfeeding? What's the total duration of breastfeeding typically? And then also, what is the period of what we call exclusive breastfeeding before they introduce weaning foods? So we like to know all of that kind of information and different health beliefs and practices about those.
I guess a lot of us would assume that breastfeeding rates are much higher in, well, pretty much many, most other countries outside of the United States. And I know that you work with many refugees who come to Iowa from, for example, different countries in Africa. I mean, do you find that most of the people that you're working with have higher rates of breastfeeding in the country that they come from?
Yes, definitely. Among the ones that I work with here in the state, absolutely, because most of them, again, are coming from a number of African countries, particularly rural areas in Africa, as well as some rural areas in Southern Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and these types of communities. So yes, we definitely see women typically, not always, but typically coming in, and they really know how to breastfeed, frankly. It's a skill, and they really know how to do it, and they have grown up in families and communities where all the women breastfeed, and they breastfeed well, and they watch what goes on, and there are lots of women and large families to help each other, multi-generational families, and everyone helping each other with the techniques of how do you actually feed an infant? How do you do that? And so lots of experienced women coming in with definitely higher rates of breastfeeding, especially, you know the World Health Organization recommends that women breastfeed exclusively just breast milk for the first 4 to 6 months of the life of the baby on demand, not on schedule, on demand for the first 4 to 6 months. And then after that, the World Health Organization recommends that mothers continue to breastfeed babies supplementally to weaning food and other, you know, food as you introduce that to a child for up to 2 years or even more. And there are very few Americans, frankly, that, you know, where we actually see that going on. But I do work with refugees on a regular basis where that is the norm, and they are still nursing as a supplement, not the exclusive form of nutrition for their baby, but they often will nurse for 2 years, even 3 years, and provide milk to the children.
Well, in this arena, then, in many ways, it sounds as if the work of encouraging and supporting breastfeeding is easier when working with immigrant populations than with our own populations in the United States.
Yeah, they certainly usually have much greater exposure to it. And again, inherently, just growing up with so many women that are just publicly and very comfortably nursing in their home communities, they get how to do that. A lot of times here in the West, we, frankly, women have relatively little exposure to what it looks like, how to do it correctly, what needs to be done. And often we need to bring in breastfeeding or lactation consultants and midwives and nurses and other people to actually teach women that have just had babies, how do you nurse? Certainly the immigrant and refugee women usually have a better base knowledge of how to nurse. But the problem is they come here, and like with so many other lifestyle practices, sometimes, unfortunately, we see their breastfeeding rates drop dramatically because they're exposed to things like formula. Many of them, of course, take jobs, and they may not have had to work in a manufacturing company or a meatpacking plant or, you know, in these types of facilities back home. Here, that's what they're doing. And those kinds of jobs are not necessarily conducive, of course, to being able to breastfeed on demand. That just, you know, that's very difficult to do. And many of them do not, for instance, then know about options like breast pumps or, you know, just ways to continue trying to get some level of breast milk in with your baby, and they don't have that type of education or knowledge in general.
You mentioned a few minutes ago some of the questions that you need to ask about different cultures and their approaches to breastfeeding. One of the things you mentioned is, what are you doing with the colostrum, that first milk that mothers produce? And I'm curious, what are some of the different answers that you might get to that question?
Mm-hmm. In general, what we hope to hear from moms and what we usually do is that colostrum is basically super breast milk. It's this, you know, supercharged breast milk. It's the first breast milk out of a mother's body. And the World Health Organization, again, recommends that women nurse within the first 1 hour of birth. That baby should already be on the breast nursing so that the baby gets a colostrum, because it's supercharged with extra immunity and you know, micronutrients, and just it's a power food, literally, for the babies. So many of the refugees and immigrants I work with, many of them know that and do that. However, sometimes you will run into cultures where the colostrum is viewed as basically it's not valued. It's seen as not real breast milk. And so the women are encouraged literally to throw it away or get rid of it or not use it. It can have different, you know, it's believed, you know, could be believed to have different kinds of properties to it that, you know, cause harm to a child or that type of thing. And in reality, with scientific studies, they're showing again that actually colostrum is most wonderful for these babies.
Are there some minor traditions or beliefs that people in working in hospital environments, for example, may not know about someone from another culture that could be useful? I've read that in some cultures, something sweet is placed into the baby's mouth before they first feed, to start their life off with sweetness, mm-hmm. things like that. Are there some of mm-hmm. these small traditions that you need to find out about and help people who may be delivering babies and taking care of babies in hospitals need to know about?
Sure. There are a huge variety of different practices around the world. And so you wind up becoming almost a medical anthropologist on top of, you know, working with a lot of these different patients. So, yes, lots and lots of questions, allowing lots of time for hospital staff to actually interview and talk with mothers from different countries, refugee immigrant moms, ahead of time. Those kinds of questions should be worked into interviewing. They should be worked into intake and assessment with these patients long before they have the actual infant, and so that these practices are known ahead of time. We do, for instance, yeah, you mentioned like the sweet thing. Sometimes dietary practices, you know, can vary a lot. Different kinds of foods can be more traditional or more valued or viewed as being something maybe taboo or something that's, again, very powerful and very important to have in the mother's diet while she's nursing. And that's just while she's nursing. And then we see a lot of variety around the world in the weaning foods. And those are the foods that are introduced usually around the world anywhere from 4 to 6 months of age as a baby begins to transition from pure breast milk to solid food. And those can vary a lot dramatically by culture. A lot of them are based on local grains, you know, their gruels, their porridges, and that type of stuff, with different fruits and things in there. You know, often in the U.S., we may buy baby food, or certainly a lot of moms make their own baby food, and they'll, you know, mush up things and blend things. I've seen mothers can be very common in a number of countries where they will chew food themselves. They'll masticate and chew food themselves and then provide that mushed up banana, for instance, or fruit or different things to the baby in addition to the gruels.
Well, and I can imagine that is a practice that, if that is done in public in the United States, in Iowa, that could turn a lot of heads. Do you talk with the mothers about some of the our cultural norms and how that may impact them as they're breastfeeding or feeding their children?
Yes, definitely. And one of the biggest ones, I've done a lot of this kind of work internationally, probably one of the biggest challenges we see cross-culturally is when you've got refugee and immigrant population moms coming in from non-Western countries, especially more traditional ones where they're in rural areas, maybe not exposed to city living, this type of thing. They suddenly come into the U.S. or they come into a Western country. And of course, normally in many of these countries, women breastfeed very openly, very publicly. It is very normal to have a mother nursing her baby on a bus or, you know, in a village or in a town or in a church or something like that. And the babies are breastfed publicly, and there is not a level of shame or stigma associated with the female breast and exposing it, those in public, to feed a child, not related to sexual types of things, but to feed a child. That's considered normal. And, of course, doing that in some Western countries, we've had issues here in the U.S. with that as well, where people can be deeply offended, find it immoral, find it offensive, and actually report the mothers to the police. You know, a number of cases, laws have had to be implemented in communities or companies or, you know, places, you know, where to make that legal rather than illegal, because it is, of course, a natural practice. We are mammals. That is what mammals do.
Well, I read a blog entry, and this is from a couple of years ago, from a Canadian mother who moved to Mongolia when her son was only 4 months old. And she was reflecting on the very different breastfeeding culture there, where, of course, in the United States or in Canada, many people try to breastfeed discreetly if they're mm-hmm. in a public place. And
correct.
And she said in Mongolia, you breastfeed wherever you are. And
yes.
often when you're breastfeeding, someone will come up and kiss your child while
yes.
they're breastfeeding. And then, of course, the baby is surprised and looks, and
yes.
then milk goes all over the place and everybody laughs. And
exactly.
So
exactly.
There are a lot,
that's
of,
true.
A lot of cultural differences.
Yes, that's true. And that is the norm. Again, that is the norm in most of the world, in most communities. We, again, in the West tend to be much more involved in more of the hiding of breastfeeding. And it should be something you do privately, you know, lactation rooms and things like that, which are very important and very, very helpful. But again, it does separate something that's very natural from the surrounding community. So it's always very interesting how
Is it difficult to explain that to mothers from other cultures?
It is. They think, well, I don't know what they think. Well, some of them have said they think we're nuts. they don't get it, why something so incredibly normal and so incredibly natural would need to be hidden away rather than something that's really celebrated. You know, again, sort of the takes a village to raise a child thing. And I think your story there in Mongolia and sort of, you know, family members and friends and people coming up, playing with kids while they're nursing, everybody kind of laughing. A lot of physical touching and this type of stuff can be very normal. And we don't always see that in Western countries and in Western communities like that. So, yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges.
Now, of course, we may have more cultural limitations on breastfeeding in public, that kind of thing, than many other cultures. Although there are cultures where there are beliefs about breastfeeding that can be very limiting for women. There are some cultures where women are expected to remain celibate while they're breastfeeding. Do you also talk with women about some of these differences?
Yes, yeah, sometimes that comes up. What we sometimes see with these populations, breastfeeding, among its many benefits, one of the benefits historically throughout evolution, you know, the evolutionary history of humans and other mammals, is that it is a way to decrease fertility. It decreases the ability to become pregnant. It is not foolproof. And as I say this, I'm sure there are many of us out there, many moms listening, they say, well, you know, I was breastfeeding and, gee, I got pregnant, you
right.
know, again for my second or third child. Yeah, those, we know that. Yeah, we know that. That definitely happens. However, it has statistically, you know, from research been shown to lower the likelihood. It is not foolproof, but it is a natural form of child spacing. And that's what we call it in public health. It's a form of child spacing. So it increases, it tends to, in populations, increase the spacing between children. So you're not having children necessarily very, very quickly one after another, but there can be, you know, maybe potentially several years in between each child born. And so that, we see that a lot where that has been practiced as a natural form of child spacing around the world in many, many cultures. The other thing, too, I was going to comment on, we were talking about the American health providers. It is good to see now that our breastfeeding rates are actually going back up in America. This is terrific among most of our racial and ethnic groups. In fact, some of the latest data shows that we have about 70%, 77% or so of our moms, at least when they leave the hospital anyway, are nursing. Now, by the time we get to about the halfway mark where the weaning food should be introduced at 6 months of age, 4, 5, 6 months of age, that rate drops to about 50%. And then, of course, it goes way down from there. We don't have enough of our mothers continuing for a year or beyond for breastfeeding as a supplement. Those rates drop way off. But nonetheless, we have gone up. Those numbers, as I said, because of a lot of the influence of, you know, thinking that the formula would be better than breast milk, those rates had really, really plummeted for quite a while. Plus, we have women working, and it is tough as a working mother. I breastfed, I was a working mom. It is very tough as a working mother to be able to breastfeed as much as we want to and the way we would like.
Do you find that with subsequent generations, once people from other cultures have come to the United States and are assimilated, do you find that the breastfeeding rates decline for these cultures?
Yes. In general, yes, around the world. When they come from some of these non-Western countries with higher rates of breastfeeding, when they come into a Western country, yes, in general, their breastfeeding rates decline. And then with other generations as they age into this and acculturate, we do see those rates picking back up again if they've been there long enough. Now, our new immigrants in Iowa, many of them have not been here long enough where we've seen that yet, but we would anticipate that that would happen down the road.
Michelle, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Charity, for covering this really important topic. Thank you.
Michelle Devlin is a professor of health promotion and education at the University of Northern Iowa. She is also director of the Iowa Center on Health Disparities. We'll continue our conversation on breastfeeding. We'll focus on our culture, cultural barriers to breastfeeding in Iowa, in the United States, and also how the culture is shifting. We'd love for you to join the conversation as well. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. What do you think the biggest barriers are? This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about breastfeeding in Iowa, how our culture perceives, supports, or discourages breastfeeding, and also support for breastfeeding moms in the workplace. With me now is Lori Bellin. She is accredited leader with Attachment Parenting International, which is a parenting support group in Des Moines. Hello, Lori.
Hello, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And also, Jennifer Pitkin is still with us. She is an international board certified lactation consultant and a leader with La Leche League, and works with businesses to help them institute breastfeeding policies for employees and patrons. And Lori, I want to start with you. We have seen in recent years the numbers, the percentage of breastfeeding moms increasing around the country and also here in Iowa. We're pretty close to the national average, just slightly above that national average in Iowa. What do we attribute the increase to?
I think there's growing awareness of the health benefits of breastfeeding, certainly, and the American Academy of Pediatrics supports exclusively breastfeeding for at least 6 months and then continuing to breastfeed for at least 12 months and longer if it works out for mother and baby. And I think there, as I said, there is a growing awareness. And I also agree with much of what Professor Devlin said, but I wouldn't exaggerate the social stigma to breastfeeding in public, because I had almost nothing but positive feedback. I nursed my kids in public many, many times and in many different locations. And I think that most people are casual about it. It's the exceptional case when somebody will make a big deal out of a woman nursing in public. I think it's much more accepted now than it was 20 to 30 years ago.
Well, and let's look back 20 to 30 years. Why was breastfeeding so discouraged and at such a low in our culture?
I think we just lost the knowledge of how to breastfeed. There was a lot of aggressive marketing by formula companies, and some doctors, frankly, encouraged formula feeding. And over time, you lose that generational support. If you grow up and you don't know what a typical breastfeeding behavior is like for babies, you don't know how often babies tend to nurse when they are breastfeeding. You don't know about the physiological changes that happen in a woman's body. It's easy to assume that either you don't have enough milk or there's something wrong with your baby.
So what do you see as the barriers to breastfeeding now for new mothers in Iowa?
I think the lack of information and support is the most important barrier because many, many women want to breastfeed. They know it's the healthiest thing for baby, but they just don't know. They don't know that it's common for a baby to nurse every hour or two around the clock in the early weeks. They don't know that growth spurts periodically happen when a baby suddenly starts nursing much more often. They don't know that cluster feeding in the evening when a baby seems to want to just nurse almost constantly for an hour or two. They don't know that after a few months, it's normal for women to stop feeling so engorged and to stop leaking, and they assume their milk is drying up. So I think support from board-certified lactation consultants and La Leche League leaders, and much of that support is free, by the way. I think if women would reach out and get that support and information, then they would understand that a lot of what may be causing them anxiety is just normal.
Well, and as you mentioned, this information is widely available, and there are many books and there are classes, and the support is there if you know to look for it. But what do you think prevents a mother from looking for that support? There still seems to be, for some people, a real difficulty with talking openly about breastfeeding.
I think that sometimes other family members, extended family, or sometimes older generations are a little bit discouraging. And it's not from a malicious motive. It's just they don't really know, and they're worried that maybe the baby might be starving because he's trying to nurse all the time. And unfortunately, I've heard of women sometimes getting misinformation from pediatricians or nurses. And so it's really valuable to seek out that information from people who are trained to help breastfeeding mothers. So lactation consultants, La Leche League leaders, the La Leche League International website is excellent. There's another good website called Kelly Mom. Dr. Jack Newman has an excellent website about breastfeeding. And I think that women just sometimes it's a question of asking for support in the right places.
Well, Jennifer, I'd love to get your take on this as well. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Sure. I would definitely like to point out that I think that a good majority of mothers are seeking out social media for breastfeeding problems that may be much more imperative that they speak to somebody who has an education and a background in human lactation. So some of these questions that mothers are posting in the middle of the night, mothers are very sweetly answering these questions. The mothers need immediate responses, but sometimes these mothers need to have a nursing session observed. They need to have their baby have a bottle feeding observed. If they are supplementing, sometimes they go in and see their physician, their OB, they see the baby's family practitioner or pediatrician, and the physician says that, you know, something like a Liptide doesn't affect breastfeeding, or if the baby is bottle feeding, the baby would clearly be able to breastfeed well. It's not true. It's simply not true. And unless somebody is observing this, they can't make that classification so simply. So they need to talk to a specialist very often. And a huge hang up to that is very often that mothers cannot afford these services, or the services end at a regular business hour. So they go home, they have an overtired infant or a struggling infant, they're having problems with breastfeeding or other children in the works, and they don't have support after hours other than social media.
Well, and I am sure that women talking to each other about breastfeeding can be very helpful. I mean, you were just saying a moment ago, Lori, that we've lost this cultural knowledge, and a lot of us can't turn to our mothers or our aunts or even necessarily sisters for this kind of information, which is how it used to be done. But there still can be problems in misinformation being passed along in the casual way, friend to friend.
And I agree entirely with everything Jennifer said. And the hands-on support, I had a very difficult time establishing breastfeeding with my first baby. And if I had not had hands-on support with positioning from a lactation consultant and from several La Leche League leaders, we would never have made it through. I did not have the family or friends to just physically show me how I needed to hold my baby. And not women have different anatomies, and not every woman can hold the baby in exactly the same position. Some women are going to find it much easier to breastfeed in different ways. And the face-to-face support is also helpful. And I was fortunate in that we had an active La Leche League chapter here, so I was able to go to meetings and meet with other mothers and get that mother-to-mother support, which is so critical.
Well, and of course, you mentioned women's anatomy varies. Babies are different from baby to baby, right? as well. I want to go to the phones, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Marcy's on the line in Mechanicsville. Hi, Marcy.
Hi. I just kind of want to chime in. I agree with both of these ladies and everything that they're saying. And I, my first child, I collectively breastfed for almost 5 years with my two children. Not 5 years old each, but collectively.
Mm-hmm.
And my first child, who is still not in a hurry to do anything, it took him 9.5 weeks to latch. And I pumped for 9.5 weeks, and I continued to go to a lactation support group at our local hospital. And if it wasn't for that support group, we would not have done it. I mean, I was fortunate in that my mother-in-law was very supportive. My mom had passed away, so I didn't have that direct, from my family. But I also, I had friends. I had a wonderful support system, and I think that is the main thing that's lacking in keeping women breastfeeding. Now, with my second child, I got together with a group of women at a local store, a local baby store called Birth Baby and Beyond. And there's a couple of them here and there, not Birth Baby and Beyond, but there's different stores that are like it. And they just happen to, the owner is a doula, and there's lactation consultants that come in, and certified lactation consultants, and they hold meetings and things like that. And I think that if you can reach out to someone who is involved in either, the hospital breastfeeding support groups, ask your hospital when you're there, ask if they have a support group for breastfeeding moms. Ask if there are any local baby shops that have, anything like that. And I know that this particular shop that I'm at is very unique in that they have several classes for kids, for babies, for breastfeeding moms, for they have game nights. They have all kinds of things just to kind of, they really focus on a family, and they focus on friendship and people that know what they're talking about.
Well, Marcy, obviously you found the support that you needed, but 9.5 weeks of not successfully breastfeeding your child, you must have been very committed to nursing to go through that.
I was very committed. And like I said, my mother-in-law was very influential in that. She kept, in her way, she kept telling me to forge on because she breastfed all of her children, even when it was not the norm.
Did you feel a lot of pressure to breastfeed?
No, I didn't. I was very stubborn. I am very stubborn.
Stubbornness helps with breastfeeding.
Yes, it does. It really, really does. And I was determined to do it. He was going to get breast milk, even if I had to pump for 2 years. He was going to get it. And eventually, I had to try some non-traditional methods to get him to finally latch on, and not ones that I would recommend because it was very painful. But eventually he did, and then he nursed like a champ for 2 years. And I actually had to, I weaned him myself. But he would have gone on forever and ever if I let him.
And the extended nursing is more common, even in Iowa. It is growing. It's not, I wouldn't say that it's common, but I know a lot of women who set out to nurse for 6 months, and boy, once they got going and they realized how easy it was, then they continued for 1 or 2 years. It's surprising how often that happens.
And the benefits continue on. The World Health Organization and UNICEF each recommend nursing past 2 years. The immunities in breast milk simply do not go away. So the benefits continue to be there, and extended nursing is beneficial for mother and baby for as long as they, or little one, I should say.
Well, now,
for as long as they continue.
From my anecdotal observations, I have to say that I think that still in our culture where breastfeeding infants and babies up to a year is getting to be more and more accepted. And I breastfed in many public places with absolutely no comment from anyone for a long time. But I do, from just, as I mentioned, observation, see more of a stigma to that long-term breastfeeding. People looking askance when somebody is breastfeeding a toddler in public.
I stopped breastfeeding my toddlers in public just because they were so distractible. It was hard to get them to settle down. But there were a few times I nursed a two-year-old on an airplane and no one said a word. I think they were relieved he wasn't screaming. And I went to the state capitol, actually. He was probably 13 or 14 months, and I was sitting down in the rotunda, and I finally got him latched on, and an older woman approached me, and I thought, oh, here we go. And she came over and leaned over and said, I nursed mine until they were three. So well, I really didn't see a lot of stigma.
I want to return to, I'm sorry, either. Jennifer?
Oh, I honestly don't either. And I believe this may be another situation that's easily attributed to lack of education on the subject. Assuming that a little one may be awkward, or that the mother is awkward because she's nursing an older little one, you may not ever see it. And the little one may genuinely need it. And health-wise, it's simply very, very good for their health and the mother's health to nurse past a year or two. But as Lori said, I have not experienced a lot of schema regarding it. And like Marcy said, and Birth Baby Beyond is a fantastic business, for the record. This is one that actually is a family-friendly business and one of our first businesses to sign on. But seeking out La Leche League, seeking out Breastfeeding USA and or Attachment Parenting International is just a really, really good choice for mothers to do while they're pregnant, so they know who to call when these situations arise past 5 p.m.
I want to return to, Marcy was talking about the very early weeks and her struggles to breastfeed her son. There are people who just are not successful and who try very, very hard to breastfeed and cannot be successful. There are other people who have different reasons that they can't breastfeed, whether that's being on a medication that's not compatible with breastfeeding that they need to be on, that kind of thing. But I have heard from women who were unable to breastfeed that they feel that in some ways there is a growing stigma to that they felt like they were shamed for not breastfeeding their babies.
I think culturally, there's still overwhelmingly more pressure to give formula than there is pressure to breastfeed. But there's no question that, especially in some social circles, there may be tremendous pressure to breastfeed. And women who didn't meet their own personal goals may feel a lot of guilt over that. Attachment Parenting International, by the way, on their website, which is www.attachmentparenting.org, has a whole page devoted to bottle feeding and bottle feeding techniques that promote a secure attachment between parents and babies. So I don't want to suggest that breastfeeding is the only way that parents and babies can get a healthy start, but we certainly do promote breastfeeding as an ideal way to feed. It doesn't work out for every mom and baby pair, but certainly women who want to breastfeed should have all the support they can get.
We have a lot of people who want to join in this conversation. I have an email from Maria who says, my first experience being pregnant and breastfeeding was when I was pregnant as a third-year medical student, and this was in 1998, so this shows us how much has changed and how recently there were serious problems. She says, first, I was discriminated against as a pregnant medical student doing clinical rotations in New Jersey. I had my baby and was not given a space to pump at the hospital. I was working as a med student, same hospital in New Jersey. Once I tried to pump in a closet in the student library. Someone reported me to the education administrator and I was written up. I was told I had to leave the hospital grounds to pump, yet I was also told that if I left the hospital during work hours, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., I would be written up. Somehow I still managed to continue to breastfeed part-time. My next rotation was in Iowa, and my hours were so long, yet I was still not allowed to pump while working. I went 2 and 3 days at a time without seeing my baby at all. That month, she was 6 months old, and my milk dried up. These experiences were part of why I walked away from my medical career. Let's take one more call, and this is from Wendy in Davenport. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I just wanted to mention that I think getting a support system set up while still pregnant was really, really helpful for me. That for me was to attend some La Leche League meetings and get familiar with the leaders so that when I was desperate with a new baby, for the first time I knew who I was calling and was more comfortable telling them about my problems.
So having the support group in place before the baby is born, is that a piece of advice that you share with mothers frequently, Lori?
Absolutely. I went to my first La Leche League meeting when I was 8 months pregnant, and it was very helpful when I was having all of my difficulties. And I think also it's what I call the preview of coming attractions. So when you're pregnant, you get a sense from listening to the other mothers what newborn breastfeeding looks like. What does it look like? What are the issues moms of 2 and 3 month old babies have? And it gives you an idea of what that range of normal is.
Lori, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you.
Lori Bellin is an accredited leader with Attachment Parenting International, a parenting support group. She is based in Des Moines. And Jennifer Pitkin, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Pitkin is an international board certified lactation consultant. She works with businesses to help them institute breastfeeding policies for employees and their patrons. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins, with technical support today from John Pemble. I'm Charity Nebbie.